important to my mother, and to have family speak is even better. So thank you.
Wonderful. So without further ado, for the last in our series of the Cyril Green Lectures, it is my privilege and pleasure to turn over the floor to Leonie Jacob.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Blau, for that introduction. And I want to echo the thanks to Nancy and Mark for sponsoring this series in memory of your mother, Nancy. May all the learning we do together be an aliyah for her neshama. I wanted to also thank each and every one of you for taking some time out of your Sunday nights or Monday mornings, as the case may be, to come together to learn. I've found that over the last number of weeks to months, learning has really taken on a whole new direction. As many shuls and schools, colleges, universities, variety of institutions have been offering a huge range of educational opportunities allow all of us to come together internationally, which is amazing. I have noticed, however, that there's been one particular avenue that has remained untapped, and that is the viewing of Bunitunt Kartut. Now, I have done some research on this, and it would appear that people who watch this form of animation, even if they have never actually read or been exposed to the classics in their original, end up developing a cultural literacy above and beyond those who don't watch this form of animation. And that has a lot to do with being exposed to the range of classic literature and a whole variety of classical composers, including Brahms, Beethoven, Rossini, just to name a few. The other educational benefit of Looney Tunes cartoons is that people who watch them get exposed to a range of characters who, no matter what happens to them, are able to just pick themselves up and keep on going. So they can be blown up, they can fall off a cliff, they can be hit by a truck, but no matter what happens, they just pick themselves up and they cope, they manage. And let's face it, unfortunately, over the last few months, the world as we knew it, figuratively, has been blown up. We've fallen off a cliff, and for many of us, we feel like we've been hit by a truck. But unfortunately, we are not managing as well as these animated characters. Preliminary figures from research done by both the San Diego and Florida State Universities reveal that there has been a significant increase in serious mental distress among American adults since the COVID-19 pandemic has begun. And you can see this here in just as a graphic image. The dark red is representative of reports of serious mental distress from 2 years ago in 2018. This bright red here is what's happening now. Many mental health institutions, variety of educational bodies have started to put out instruction manuals as to how to cope under these circumstances that develop these road to resilience, which is not an easy thing to develop, because even within the field of resiliency research, there is still debate as to what resiliency actually is. In 2013, the International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies got together in their meeting and in their plenary session had a panel discussion between a variety of professionals who all came from different disciplines to discuss what is the definition of resilience, what are its determinants, and how do we get there? How do we develop this elusive trait? And not surprisingly, our panel, made up of a psychiatrist, psychologist, a professor of child development, and a professor of anthropology, all came up with different answers. So I thought there would be some value in trying to gain a perspective on resilience from a Torah angle. What does the Torah have to say about resilience and how we can develop it? Now, on first glance, you'd be forgiven for thinking that the Torah has nothing to say on the subject. There is no Torah word for resilience, and there's definitely no instruction manual as how to get there. But as Ben Bugbug, which is incidentally one of my favorite names for a rabbi, says in Ethics of the Fathers, in chapter 5, Mishnah 22, Ben Bugbug omer, hafoch bo vehafoch bo dechula bo. Turn it over, for everything is contained within it. Within that spirit, I want to spend the remainder of the time we have together this evening taking a close look at three main characters from Tanakh, characters which are familiar to all of us, with a view to try to piece together from their stories an approach to resilience from a Torah perspective. And hopefully through that, we can figure out not only how to survive these challenging times in which we live, but to thrive as well. So I want to begin with the character Miriam. Miriam, her very name gives us a hint as to the times that she was born into. The Midrash, the Yalkut Shimoni, teaches us, "Vatahar ha'isha vateled bat, vatikra et shema Miriam." Right? A woman became pregnant. She gave birth to a daughter. She called her name Miriam. "Vayamim ahem hechelu hamitzrim lemarer chayei bnei Yisrael." In those days, the Egyptians began to embitter the lives of Bnei Yisrael. Miriam was born into a time of national crisis. Jewish people had been living in times of relative affluence and comfort and were suddenly thrust into slavery. But at around this time, presumably when she was born, a new level of inui, of oppression and embitterment began. Paro made his decree that all the baby boys were to be thrown into the Nile River, the horror of which one can only begin to imagine. And the all-pervading feeling among the Jewish people at this time must have been fear, panic, uncertainty, helplessness. And it would seem that that is the point from which the leadership responds. If you take a look here, Tana Amram Gadol Hador Haya, Kevan Shara'ash Amar Paro, Kola Ben Hayilud, Amar Lashav Anu Amalim. We're taught that Amram, Miriam's father, he was the Gadol Hador, he was the leader of the generation. And when he saw that Paro had said that every son, every boy that was born, had to be thrown into the Nile, he said, "We are toiling for nothing. This is worthless." Amad v'gareshet ishto. He stood and he divorced his wife. Amdu kulan v'gareshu et neshotehen. Everybody followed suit. Everyone decides it's time we're going to divorce our wives. Better nobody should be born than that the boys should be thrown into the Nile. But Miriam emerges as our individual who is best able to adapt to adversity and trauma. She stands up and not only does not succumb to the helplessness, but inspires all of those around her in order to take a different course of action. Amar le bito, daughter says to him, Miriam turns to her father. She says, "Abba, zeratcha kashe mishel paro. Your decree is more difficult. It's more harsh than that of Paro. Sheparo lo gazar ela al hasfarim. Paro only decreed on the boys. Va'ata gozer al hasfarim ve'al hanekevot. You are decreeing not only on the boys, but on the girls as well. Paro lo gazar ela be'olam hazeh. Va'ata gazarta be'olam hazeh uve'olam haba. Paro decrees will only take place in this world. Your decree, Father, it will have an effect not only in this world, but also in the world to come. Paro rashahu, safek mitkayemet, gzerato safek. Evil, wicked individual. It's doubtful whether his decree will even take place. Ve'ata tzadik, gzeratcha mitkayemet. But you, Father, you are a tzaddik, you are a righteous man. Your decree will stand. And Amram listens. Amad v'hechzir et ishto, amdu kulan v'hechzir et neshotehen. They all return to their wives. And Miriam has had a very major impact by her ability to kind of, I guess, transcend these general feelings of anxiety at the time and recognize that something else needs to be done. The story doesn't end there, because after Amram remarries his wife and Moshe is born, 3 months later, it becomes apparent that they can no longer hide Moshe. And Miriam becomes thrust into a situation of a different form of adversity. Take a look in the Mechilta, the Midrash on Shemot. They could no longer hide him. Nazaf ba avia. The father now turns to Miriam. He rejects her. Amar la biti hechan vuataych. Says, where's your prophecy now? The odamach zeket menivuata. But Miriam nevertheless stands firm. Her father rejects her. He is unbelievably upset at what is happening. Their son Moshe is now in danger. But she doesn't waver. She remains strong in the face of rebuke and rejection, not only from her father, but from the leader of the generation. And this strength that she generates is quite amazing. It's something that's picked up on by the Midrash in Mishlei, in Proverbs chapter 31, which is a Midrash which analyzes every pasuk, every verse of the famous poem we read on Friday nights. We sing Eshet Chayil, Woman of Valor. And it equates each pasuk to a different biblical character. The eighth pasuk, Chagra be'oz matneha v'ta'amet zroteha. She girds her loins with strength and makes her arms strong. This, says the Midrash, is Miriam. Zo Miriam, shekodem shenolad Moshe, amra, atida imi sheteled ben shemoshia et Yisrael. Before Moshe was born, she said, I know that my mother will in the future bear a son who will save Israel. Kevan shenolad v'chabed alehem ol malchut. But when he was born and things became even harder, the kingdom of Egypt began to oppress them even more. Amad aviyah v'tapcha al rosha. Her father stood and tapped her on the head. Amar la, echa nevotayich. Where's your prophecy now, Miriam? Va'amad v'yarok b'fanei. And he spat in front of her. This is a much harsher rendition of the story we saw in the previous Midrash, where Amram is very, very greatly casting her away. Ve'imkol zot. But even with all of this, she stays strong in her prophecy. As it says, and she stood, his sister stood from afar. In the book of Shemot, in the book of Exodus, when baby Moses is put into the little basket and put onto the Nile, right? We know she stands to look from afar, and we're told to see what happens to him. It's not just that she's trying to see whether or not he'll be okay. She's standing to see that her prophecy comes true. She is standing steadfast and strong. And I think that when we think about Miriam's story, or at least when I think about Miriam's story, it brings to mind what I think most of our reactions are to the word resilience, right? She's somebody who is able to stand strong and not waver, no matter what the obstacles, right? She's the Energizer Bunny. She just keeps going and going and going. It doesn't matter what's happening. She is a beacon of light. She inspires. Throughout her story, she never wavers. She never collapses. She doesn't even cry. She just does and believes what she needs to in order to get the job done. Miriam's resilience is that described by our professor of psychiatry from the panel discussion that took place in 2013. Rachel Yehuda, who I believe is originally a Clevelander, puts forth the idea that resilience is really a process of not so much a process, but it is the idea of moving forward and not looking back. And that, she says, is determined by biology. Miriam does not go through a process of developing resilience. She's just resilient. Some people, just by their very nature, by what is inherent within them, are able to be resilient. Our next character is that of Chana. We're first introduced to Chana at the beginning of the book of Shmuel, where we're told that she is one of two wives of a very prominent individual named Elkanah. Elkanah loves Chana very much. He gives her many gifts of food and constantly shows her affection. But as we are told many times in the first few verses, Chana is childless. Hashem has closed her womb. This is unlike Miriam, whose crisis takes place on a national level, along with her wider community. This is a much more personal, specific crisis. And that is the crisis of infertility. Every year, Chana goes with her family up to the house of God. As we see here in verse 7 of chapter 1 of Shmuel, V'chen ya'aseh shana b'shana, every single year, Midei Altav Bevet Hashem, she would go up with her family to the house of God, which was placed in Shiloh. Techasena v'tivkeva lo tochel. She is, it seems, verbally abused by her co-wife, Penina, who's taunting her in some way. And Chana's response is to cry and to not eat. And it would seem from the way this pasuk is worded that this is something that goes on all the time. There is no positive, constructive action that Chana takes. She just is constantly in a state of crying and not being able to eat. And then something changes. Vayomer la Elkana Isha. One year, her husband Elkana turns to her and says, Chana, lama tivki? Velama lo tochli? Velama yira levavech? Chana, why are you crying? What's your problem? Why are you not eating? Why are you so sad? Halo anochi tov lach ma'asara banim? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? What does Chana do in response? Vatakam Chana achre achla. Right? After she has something to eat, right? She gets up, achare shata, and she's had something to drink. Ve'eli ha-kohen yashav al kiseh mezuzot hechal Hashem. We're told a little side point. Eli sitting on the chair at the entrance to the house of God. Ve'hi marat nefesh v'titpalel al Hashem u'bacho tivkeh. And she is very bitter of soul. She davens to Hashem. Something fundamental here seems to have shifted. In response to her husband's rhetorical question, which seems to demonstrate an unbelievable insensitivity to her current state of being, she seems to have something inside of her snap. She's steeled by this new determination, and she finally gets up and takes action. Now, on first glance, the action doesn't seem to be that significant. Okay, she forces herself to eat something, she gets up, she moves to a different location, and she continues to cry. But if you take a closer look at the way the pasuk is worded, there's something very strange in pasuk yud. Right? And if I was writing the story, I would write, and she was very bitter of soul, marat nefesh, and she davened to Hashem and cried. Right? The word here, I would write as v'titpalel el Hashem, but that's not what the pasuk says. The pasuk says she was bitter of nefesh, bitter of soul rather, v'titpalel al Hashem. She davened on Hashem, or against Hashem. The Gemara in Brachot, Daf Lamed Aleph Amud Bet, page 31b, seems to pick up on this textual anomaly and elaborates on this interaction between Chana and Hashem. Amra Chana lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Chana says before Hashem, Ribono shel Olam, im ra'a mutav ve'im lav tir'eh. If you have seen my suffering and you will give me a child, see the subtext here, good. And if not, you will see. Elech ve'estater b'fnei Elkana ba'ali. I'm going to go and seclude myself in front of Elkana, my husband. V'kevan d'mistatarna mashkuli mei sota. And because I have secluded myself, they're going to give me the waters of the sota to drink. Hannah says to Hashem, I'm going to put myself in a position where my husband is going to suspect me of being adulterous. I'm not actually going to do anything, but I'm going to make him suspect so that you have to take me and give me the waters of the sota. And it says in the Torah that if somebody drinks the waters of the sota and is found to be innocent of any adulterous activity, then they will be blessed with a child. It says Hannah, I'm going to put myself in that position, Hashem. You wouldn't want to make your Torah a fraud now, would you? As it says, she will be cleansed and will have a child. The outcome of drinking the waters of the sota will result in cleansing her name and having a child. Chana is not pleading helplessly before God. Chana is giving him an ultimatum. She's saying to him, God, you give me a child, or I'm going to show the whole world what a fraud you really are. That's fighting words. That's not somebody helplessly crying and pleading. She does cry immediately after that. And the double language, bachot tivkeh, indicates she's crying on a level she hasn't cried before. But that crying seems to be a form of catharsis. Because if we look what happens at this point, she becomes a different person. V'telecha isha ledalka v'tochal upaneh lo hayo la'ot. The woman goes on her way, she eats, and her face is not as it had been. This picture painted of Hannah's journey does not immediately gel with what we might originally think of as being resilience. I mean, she spends years and years suffering without taking any kind of action whatsoever. And when she finally does, it's in response to rejection of her and her emotional reality by somebody close to her. But recover she does, and she goes home victorious. Hannah's form of resilience is that, as described by the professor of anthropology, Catherine Panter-Brick, who says that resilience is not to be understood as an attribute or a capacity, but rather that it is a process. The determinants of resiliency, based on this definition, are having a sense of hope for the future, that it is going to be better than the past and the present. And Hannah's hope in her future is rewarded when she finally returns home and is blessed with her much-desired son. The crisis is resolved, she recovers, and she's able to move on. Lastly, I want to take a look at Leah. We're first introduced to Leah here in the book of Bereshit as one of Lavan's two daughters, the elder. Right? The elder was Leah, the younger was Rachel. And the first description we ever hear about Leah is Ve'enei Leah Rakot. Leah's eyes were soft. And Rashi very famously quotes the Gemara in Baba Batra to tell us that her eyes were soft because she was crying continuously over her lot in life. Mai rakot, why were they soft? Rav Amar, ne'olam rakot mamash, they were actually soft. Ve'lo g'nai hula, this is not something that is to be said as a disgrace to her. Ela shevachu, it is a praise. She'hayta shomat al parshat pachim b'nei adam, she'ayu amrim, Shnei banim yesh la Rivka, shnei banot yesh lo Lavan, tola legadol v'ktana lekatan. She used to hear people talking at the crossroads, and they would say, Rivka has two sons, Lavan has two daughters, let the elder marry the elder, and the younger marry the younger. V'hata yoshevet al parshat tachim u'mashelet, and she would sit there and she would ask, Gadol mama asav, well, who is this elder? What are his deeds? What's he like? He's an evil man who robs people. Katan, mama asav, what about the younger? Ishtam yoshev ohalim. He is a simple man who sits in tents, dwells in tents. And she would cry and cry and cry until her eyelashes fell out. Leah cannot envisage the possibility of a reality where she ends up married to this wicked individual. And we're told in the Midrash that she would cry, she would daven, she was pleading to Hashem, please, please God, do not let me fall into the lot of this wicked man. And Hashem answers her prayers. Not only does she not end up married to Esau, but she becomes the first wife of Yaakov. When the dust settles, it becomes very apparent that Leah is continuing to exist within a world of difficulty. She is constantly competing with her sister for her husband's affections, and she's losing. Unlike Miriam's crisis, which takes place on a national level, or Hannah's, which is a specific personal crisis, Leah's day in, day out existence is one of challenge and difficulty. It's subacute, it's less intense, but it's like that drip, drip, drip of water that can bury a groove, make a groove into a stone. Every encounter we have with Leah from this point at the beginning, it's heartbreaking, it's unbelievably painful. We take a look in chapter 29, verse 31. Vayar Hashem kisnu alea. Hashem saw that Leah was hated. Vatahar Leah vateled ben vatikra shmo Reuven ki amra ki ra'a Hashem ba'oni ki ata yahaveni ishi. She has a son. She names him Reuven, and she says, "Maybe now my husband will love me." Then she has another son. V'taharod v'teled ben v'tomar ki shama Hashem ki snu'a anochi. V'yiten li gam et zeh. She becomes pregnant, she has another son. Maybe Hashem has heard how hated I am. Verse 34, V'taharod v'teled ben v'tomar ata hapam yalave ishi elai. Ki yaladti lo shlosha banim. She's pregnant, she has another child. And now she says, maybe now my husband will accompany me, for I have given him three sons. The pain is almost palpable. She's yearning for things to be different, for her husband to love her. And then all of a sudden, in the very next verse, she has another son. But we see a very different Leah emerging. V'taho od v'teled ben v'tomar hapam ode et Hashem al ken kra shmo Yehuda v'ta'omed miledet. Comes pregnant, she has another son. She says, this time I am going to thank Hashem. And so she calls his name Yehuda, and she stops having children at that point. Leah has suddenly shifted from somebody who is focusing only on herself and on her own lack and on her own challenge to somebody who has developed a sense of gratitude. And as Repetin Holly Pavlov notes in a character analysis done of Leah, says gratitude is based on our perception of the reality in which we find ourselves. Leah has managed to move from naming her children out of a fragile sense of relationship with Yaakov to naming her child out of a place of strength in her relationship with Hashem. Leah's begun to realize that sometimes things that may be unpleasant or may be difficult may actually be gifts from God. She starts to recognize the significance of her life and her role in the Jewish people as a whole, and is able to completely shift her perspective to one of positivity. There is no specific event that propels Leah to make this change and to take any action, and there's no real action that actually takes place. And unlike Miriam and Hannah, who both lived to see their crises resolved, Leah lives with hers for the rest of her life. Yaakov always loves Rachel more. But Leah is able to take that reality, recognize it for what it is, put it to one side, and focus on the good. She does that which is necessary in order to allow her to move forward. And it reminds me a lot of a piece that was written in 1987 by a mother of a child with disabilities. Many of you may have heard of this piece. It's called Welcome to Holland. And for those of you who have not read it, there's a link at the bottom of the source sheet. It very briefly describes the journey of a mother who was expecting to have a healthy child and ends up with one who is not. And makes an analogy between that and somebody who has been dying to go to Italy. They cannot wait. They've been planning this for months, and all they can think about is Italy. And then, very surprisingly, the plane suddenly lands in Holland. And all they can feel is a sense of immense disappointment, because all they wanted to do was go to Italy, and they can't go, and they're not there, and they're missing out on all the things they've been looking forward to. But as this author points out, if we stay fixated on that aspect of loss, then we may very well miss out on appreciating what is unique about Holland. And that reminds me very much about this process that Leah seems to have gone through at this point. The next number of psukim that deal with Leah tell us about all the actions she does take in order to ensure that the Jewish people continue. She gives Yaakov her maidservant as a concubine, and she is the one who names the two children that result from their union. She then bargains with Rachel for an extra night with their husband, and based on that union, conceives and gives birth to another child that is to make up another one of the tribes of Israel. Leah just gets on with the act of living, which I believe is resilience in its very essence. Leah's brand of resiliency is that in line with our professor of child development, Dr. Anne Marston, who writes, and I quote, "Resilience is the capacity of a dynamic system to adapt successfully to disturbances that threaten the viability, development, or function of that system. And this, says Dr. Marston, is embedded in relationships that provide emotional security and the feeling that someone has got your back. And in the case of Leah, this is Hashem. So there we have three individuals, three different stressors, three different journeys. What can these the lives of these three women teach us about the Torah's perspective on resilience? I think the first thing it teaches us is why there's such ambiguity about what the definition of resilience and its determinants actually are, because resilience can take multiple forms and have multiple different types of determinants. It can be a capacity or an attribute, or it can be a process that somebody goes through. It can be an act of moving forward and not looking back, or it can be a state of staying where you are, but adapting to the reality and the circumstances in which you find yourself. But I believe the Torah does a lot more than just support the findings of modern resiliency research. Although these three women may be quite different in many ways, there are a number of points that unify their stories. First of all, each of these three women is rejected by somebody who they find very close to them. In the case of Miriam, it's her father, and in the case of Hannah and Leah, it's their husbands. But in all three cases, they recognize that they are not alone. Hashem is with them. As David HaMelech, as King David says in the Psalms, in chapter 27, Tehillim, Ki avi ve'imi azavuni, v'Hashem ya'asfeni, my mother and father may have abandoned me, but Hashem has gathered me in. Resilience from a Torah perspective depends and relies on a living, tangible relationship with God. Secondly, I believe that when we take all these three women's stories together, they demonstrate the necessity in developing a balanced perspective in response to crisis. Miriam and Hannah, their stories really demonstrate to us two extreme responses that can occur in the midst of a crisis. Miriam is faced with her father Amram's response. Amram, in response to the crisis generated by Paro, although his response is well-intentioned, it is disproportionate and results in unforeseen and unintended consequences. You can see that by the way in which Miriam interacts with him. She says, "Father, your decree, your solution to this problem gets rid of boys and girls. Paro's only got rid of the boys. Father, your solution is worse than the crisis itself." It demonstrates an extreme response on one plane. Hannah, on the other hand, is faced with her husband's response to crisis, which is basically to completely minimize it and almost deny that there was any crisis there to begin with. He doesn't take it seriously enough to actually do anything at all. Right? When we see other individuals faced with infertility, such as Rivka, we see that her husband Yitzchak is davening alongside with her to ask Hashem, "Please Hashem, let this crisis abate, let my wife be blessed with a child." Never do we see that Elkanah davens or does anything. And he clearly is not able to see that there is a crisis. He's in some form of denial. In order to be able to cope with any situation, we need to be able to develop a balanced perspective. We need to accurately and critically identify the nature of the crisis, and we need to be able to develop an appropriate and measured and proportionate response. Once we're able to do this, that is when Leah's perspective kicks in. Because once we know what the crisis is and we know what we need to do, now we need to learn and teach ourselves to focus on the good and to be able to frame the situation in which we find ourselves positively. Finally, the third thing that unifies these three characters is encapsulated beautifully by a description that was penned by Sherry Mandel, the mother of Kobe, a 13-year-old boy who was brutally murdered by Arabs in 2001. She says, "Resilience is connected to both the words for silence and for salience. What once silenced you and felt beyond language now propels you to salience, to seek heightened meaning and significance." All three of our characters became greater as a result of their life trajectory. We find that with Miriam, we're told in Gemara Ta'anit, Daf Bet Amud Aleph, 9a, Rabbi Yossi Barabbi Yehuda Omer, Shlosha Parnasim Tovim Amdu Li Yisrael, Eluhen, Moshe, Ve'aron, Ve'Miriam. Miriam is one of the three great leaders who stood for Israel alongside her brothers, Moshe and Aharon. Tanu Rabbanan, in Gemara Baba Batra, we're told, Shisha lo shalat behen malach ha-mavet, ve'eluhen, Avraham, Yitzchak, Ve'yakov, Moshe, Aharon, u'Miriam, Miriam nami, b'neshika meta. We are taught there were six people over whom the angel of death did not rule. Miriam was one of them. She is one of six individuals who died by divine kiss. And we're taught, Tanu Rabbanan, Shiva lo shalat behen rimavet hole'a, ve'eluhen, Avraham, Yitzchak, Ve'yakov, Moshe, Aharon, u'Miriam, u'Binyamin. There are seven whose bodies never decomposed. And Miriam was one of those. Chana, we're told, is one of two individuals who gave a praise of Hashem unlike any other. As we find in the Zohar on Parshat Vayikra, Ta, Chazi, Trein Nashin an Inun, De Ishtakache Ba'alma. There are two women we find in the world. Va'amar Eitush Bechata, Bekudsha Brichu, Bechol Govrin Ba'alma Loyim Munachi. They gave a praise of God that no man had ever given. Uman Inun, who are these two women? Dvorah v'Chana. Chana is one of these two women. All of our halachot of tefillah that we have today derive from Chana. She is the one who taught us a new understanding of Hashem and how to interact with Hashem. And as for Leah, Leah became the mother of the majority of the tribes of Israel. She is the one who is perceived to be the eternal spiritual wife of Yaakov. After all, she is the one buried in Ma'arat HaMachpelah. And she taught us how to give praise, or how to give thanks and gratitude, rather, of Hashem. As we're told in the Gemara in Brachot, Amar B'Yochanan, Mishum Al-Bichimon Ben Yochai, Miyom Shebara HaKadosh Baruch Hu Et Olamo, Lo Haya Adam Shehoda LaKadosh Baruch Hu Ad Shebaata Lea Behodato. Rabbi Yochanan says in the name of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, from the day that Hashem created his world, there was no person who gave thanks to God until Leah came and showed her gratitude. Leah teaches us how to have gratitude of Hashem. At the end of the day, resilience from a Torah perspective is not about recovering from setbacks or adversity, being able to pick ourselves up after falling off a cliff or being hit by a truck, and just keeping on going. Resilience is about taking that adversity, taking those setbacks, and making them into opportunities for becoming better people. Resilience is not about overcoming, it's about becoming. I hope that each and every one of us are able, from within the situations that we find ourselves, to view them and find the opportunities to help us develop a more balanced perspective, to develop a deeper sense of relationship with God, and to take a number of additional steps on our personal journeys to becoming better people. I wish everybody a Chag Sameach. If anyone has any questions or comments, please feel free to unmute yourselves. I welcome any thoughts. I open up the floor.